It is now my pleasure to introduce a person who needs no introduction. Helen Garner, the creator of such luminous works as Monkey Grip, as The House of Grief, First Stone, and one of my favourite collections of recent years, the scintillating and searing-eyed piece of journalism called Everywhere I Look, a collection of Helen's journalistic pieces. And she has a new collection out, not a collection of stories, not a collection of journalistic pieces, but a collection, in fact, smithereens of herself. It's called Helen Garner, Yellow Notebook, Diaries, Volume 1, 1978 to 1987. Good evening, Helen.
Hello, David.
Gee, it sounds a little ominous. Volume 1.
Yes, it's a bit risky putting Volume 1 on anything, I think.
I mean, I know that many friends have looked you in the eye and said, why, Helen, why? What's the simple answer to that question?
Actually, none of my friends have asked
well,
me that.
Let me ask you that myself.
You can be the first. Well, how can I answer? Well, I've been keeping a diary since I was a girl, really. I burnt a lot of it. There's a whole burning story in this. But I went and looked back at some of the... you'll remember, if you like that book, Everywhere I Look, there were some chunks of diary in that, which were reasonably recent diaries. But people responded to that, surprisingly, and I really enjoyed digging them out and putting them together. And I thought, well, I wonder if there's anything further back. So I went and had a look, and some of the stuff, it just seemed like it might be interesting to people, and I kind of rather liked it myself, so that's why.
So that bonfire, what sparked that, no pun intended, why the incineration of previous journals of Helen Garner?
Well, what happened was, one time I was thinking about the dismissal of the Whitlam government. I was just sort of pondering it in my memory, and I thought, I wonder what I wrote about that in my diary. And I went and got out the volume in question, and I found I hadn't even mentioned it, although it was so, you know, such a disaster for everybody, and we were all rushing out on the streets to demonstrate. But I hadn't mentioned it. So I thought, well, I'll have a look at the diary. And so I read sort of backwards from that date, and I read forwards from that date, and I found there was a lot of stuff there that was rather tedious to me as a fully grown up, which I was by the time I was looking at it.
So what was it that was preoccupying you while matters of state were just occurring in the background, like Icarus and Daedalus suddenly plunging into the ocean?
Oh, just personal life. But actually, most diaries, in my experience, the ones I enjoy reading, don't talk about affairs of state. I remember noticing... somebody was reviewing a book of diaries of women around the time of the French Revolution, and they were surprised to find that they often just didn't even mention the French Revolution that was going on. And I remember laughing at that and thinking, oh, I totally understand that, because that isn't what a diary is for. It's not for recording. Well, there are some people who, perhaps politicians, like to keep a diary that's about affairs of state, but most people are working much closer to home and on the things that personally concern them.
In fact, you just reminded me that a wonderful collection of wartime correspondence from the wives of soldiers who were in action was such a rich source of life that was happening at home, all the privation and the improvisation, and a lot of gossip.
Was that mass observation?
It was actually Alistair Thompson at Monash was responsible for putting all these together. Ah. And what it caught was, you know, wasn't affairs of state, wasn't the kind of grand conflicts and all the correspondence. It was all about lives and trying to work the mangler out, trying to make the most of mock chicken pie with using tripe.
Yeah.
So can we turn our, if you've got a couple of sections there marked out, I think it would really be lovely for listeners to hear a couple of excerpts. The first one I'd love you to read out, Helen, is it's quite early on, so I think it would be possibly in 1978, 79, so you're in your late 30s, and you just pulled into Griffith in the combi.
Oh, yeah, wait a minute, what page is that?
That's on page 70, I think it's there.
70. Yeah, I was on my way to Griffith because I had a gig at, that is Griffith University, I was going to in Brisbane. Was it 79?
Page 70, page 70.
Oh, 70, oh,
yeah.
Sorry, there's
no worries.
Some rustling going on here. Oh, yeah, here it is. Oh, yeah, okay. Heading for Griffith University in the combi. At nightfall, I walked down the main street of Gundagai, eating hot chips out of newspaper. The lumpy little hill straight ahead of me was dead black, its silhouette fringed with the odd gum. The fading light behind it, airy, mauve and pure, seemed to be projected upwards towards two horizontal streaks of grey cloud. In my motel room, the double bed sank in the middle before I even got into it. A deep sleep. Dreams of Paris, climbing flights of stairs. I peeped out at dawn and saw darkness and thick frost on the combi's windscreen. How comforting it is to write in this notebook in an awful room so far from home. I write and become lord of all I survey.
That, to me, is one of the keystone entries and really just sang out to me. The comfort of diary writing, it seems to create a continuity in the chaos, you know, the centre of the chaos of life. Mm. What prompted, you said you've been keeping a diary for many, many years. What were the prompts that led you to that habit?
Oh, it's so long ago now that I can hardly remember. I mean, you know, when I was a teenager. Mm. I do remember I was the oldest in a quite big family, and I was always trying, I was a bit of a swot, and all I wanted to do was read and be get away on my own. And I think that's probably how it started. I remember in one of the houses we lived in, there was this terrible old shed out in the backyard when we first moved in, and I was poking around out there to see what was in it. And there was this little section that had a little window and a bench. I think it was probably some bloke's workbench in a previous life. And I thought, gee, this is really nice. I could just sit out here and I could maybe write something out here. And I got an exercise book and a pencil or a biro, and I just used to sit there. And I don't remember actually writing anything when I was in there, but I really liked being in that private spot.
There's a lovely quote from Sancho Panza, of all people, in Don Quixote, who says that it's interesting as yesterday's clouds. that is kind of like a forecast we don't need to know anymore.
That's lovely.
It is lovely, because what you capture in this diary is the perpetual present. And so therefore weather matters, the choice of shoes matters. It must have been quite exacting for you to go through now as essentially an editor, or at least a curator of your journal notes. How did you manage to kind of work out what was to remain?
It's hard to answer that, because I didn't think up any criteria. I rather more just dived in at a certain point, which was around about when I was in Paris, living briefly there with my daughter when she was quite young. She was about 8. And I was very lonely there. And I thought, oh, maybe it gets interesting here. This is where... And so I just started randomly typing it up. And I just left out the boring bits, basically, and anything that looked as if it might... if it gave me a little buzz when I read it, a buzz of memory or a buzz of something I'd actually forgotten, and it reminded me of some Parisian thing, like the fact that you had to pay to go to the toilet in a park, or or the sorts of flowers that bloomed in certain gardens there. And I thought, oh, this is really nice. Well, I'll just put these down. And they just turned out to be little chunks. I mean, some of them are only 2 lines long. And then I went on, and then I got into more, especially coming back to Australia, everything, I suppose, became more about sort of family life, particularly about my daughter. And I was married at the time too. And, you know, dogs we had, and what we bought at the market, and things like that seemed kind of interesting to me. So I left out the boring bits. And I was interested in the bits about writing. I was quite surprised, in fact, sometimes astonished by the things that were in there about writing.
In fact, that's the other thing that sits central, is the craft of writing and the neurosis of writing, the triumph of writing, the self-doubts. It's all in there. And in fact, I really enjoyed following that line of evolution. It was like watching you become a writer in front of me. You chose those Paris years. You're in your late 30s. You were with your daughter. You're living in Paris, 1978. So what was different in those, on the page at least, compared to all those more juvenile diaries that you destroyed?
Mm. Well, looking back, I think I was more outward turned. I was looking at things more. I was in a strange environment, so things struck me differently. And also I wasn't embedded in a social world. And, of course, that was quite I was lonely, and I wasn't in that world of mush and love and romance that I'd lived in, apparently uncomplainingly, for quite some time.
While Whitlam was getting turfed out of office.
Yeah.
It is 18 minutes to 8 o'clock. You're with David Astle on ABC Evening. And I'm chatting to Helen Garner, who is the curator, I suppose, as much as the culprit, of the Yellow Notebook, Diaries Volume 1, 1978-1987, a collection of her journals from that period. And it will be on public release in early November, I think, next week, Helen?
Next week, yeah, next Tuesday.
And also you will be appearing as part of an incredible event. It's called the Broadside Festival. I'll give you details of that. You're in conversation with Sarah Krasnstein. Before we talk about that, however, I'm going to ask, why were you tempted at any point to tackle the more orthodox task of an autobiography, given that this has the kind of template for such a book?
No. I'm not interested in writing memoir as such, and I'm not interested in writing... I would never write an autobiography. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason is that, my work is always pretty close to my own life. I used to get criticised for that a lot, but I think people kind of dropped off and figured that that was what I was going to do. But, so, no, I don't think I find... I actually love reading other people's lives. I like to read memoir in the sense that people don't say, you know, I was born on such and such a day and my parents came from so-and-so and my grandparents came. You know, I just start yawning at that point. But I like books of memoir when something awful has happened to somebody or something really interesting has happened and they're going to tell how they dealt with it. I love that. And I think that whole modern stream of memoir is, I can really take any amount of that.
Who... did you have in mind when you were writing the diary? Who was the reader?
As a reader?
Mm.
Well, I couldn't really say. That's almost impossible to answer. I never know who... Well, any act of utterance assumes a reader, but I would never have one in mind that I would tailor the thing to. I suppose I'm talking to somebody who I think is interested in the same things I'm interested in, and that's quite broad.
So an older, wiser, more decorated Helen Garner going back to the younger developing self, what surprised you in reading your younger persona?
I was surprised at my foolishness and the degree of self-hatred that I express. I can't say I'm surprised by it because, I still feel those things now, but it is actually quite mortifying going back and reading stuff. And I found it's like just watch yourself again and again sort of prancing towards the edge of a cliff and going straight over the edge again and again, and you don't know. You realise that as a young person you didn't have a handle on your own drives and your own habits and the things that were going to make you miserable. And so again and again, oh, I'm in love, he's so wonderful, and then over the edge.
Spoiler alert. There's another, in fact, I just also want to emphasise how funny this is. There are so many set pieces that just tickled me. They were full of schadenfreude, they were full of sharp detail, concise. It was almost seeing you become more scalpel-like in your application of prose. And there's a lovely moment in a cafe, in fact, and I think it's on page 59. Thank you for indulging us all with little grabs. This is a moment where a gentleman caught your eye in a cafe.
All right. The fat man in the cafe saw through the window that his Citroen was about to be booked. He sprang up, lumbered to the door, and tried to clown his way out of it. He advanced towards the parking attendant with his hands clasped behind his back and a bouncing, knee-bending gait like a naughty child faking repentance. She looked up at him with a stony face. He dropped it and started to argue. She ignored him and kept writing. He got into the car and made as if to drive off. She tried to push the ticket through the half-open window, but he screwed it up, shoved it back at her and roared away, leaving the pink leaf fluttering on the road at her feet. "Why should he be able to bludgeon a cafe," said F, "while she has to work all over Easter?"
You know, the other thing I loved about this collection, Helen, is it brought Melbourne back to life. You know, the kind of older Melbourne. Even you're walking down Rathdown Street to collect some repaired shoes. There are the open door of the trams. Was it, to what degree was it a nostalgia project for you going back, looking at all these traces?
The world that's changed.
The world that was.
Oh, well, I was happy about that, but I guess. It wasn't something that came consciously to me, and I didn't think that it had changed all that much. Did you feel that it was very different?
I suppose the fact that your life was often orbiting around post offices, letters, and kind of errands. You know, there was a lot of errand running, and I think these days we just tend to do that with the mouse button and, you know, an email.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Oh, that's really nice. I'm thrilled that you noticed that, because I mean, it doesn't seem all that strange to me to go to the post office and buy some stamps. But it is true, isn't it? Just people don't do that anymore. Gosh, that's rather shocking. I'm really taken aback.
The other thing too is that the codex or the legend of the characters, and we've heard the fat man, who obviously was not a close associate, but in there we've got the born again, the biographer, the law student. We've got F. We just heard from F. U seems to be a very close friend. How did you work out, you know, the alphabet of it all, or the epithets? Must have been quite difficult, particularly given that some of this was quite sensitive or caustic at times.
Yeah. Well, I thought at the beginning, I'm not going to identify people. Partly because, I mean, I don't know how people feel about being in my diary. I have asked quite a few people who are in it if they're okay with it. And most of them were okay with it and didn't want to see it first. Others weren't. Well, there was one person who was not okay with it, but I thought, well, how can I identify? How can I? I had this idea that I could describe people because in my reading group we read Homer some years ago, and I really liked what's called the Homeric epithet, which is, you know, the grey-eyed goddess, mm-hmm. the wine dark sea, those little phrases, little tags that, and I thought, oh, I could try that. So I tried that for a while, and I had, you know, the curly-headed one, or the married man, or the biographer, or the law student, and then I figured, no, this isn't going to work, and the editor didn't think it worked either, and I was rather disappointed, but I could see that it wasn't going to work. So she suggested that they should have an initial, and I really didn't like that idea at all. And then I thought, well, I could just give them random initials and just one initial each. They don't have to have two or a full stop or anything like that. So then I just randomly distributed initials, and I only just squeaked it in. I mean, how many letters are there in the alphabet?
Well, we know there's 26, but there's some. There's, what's lovely is that this whole galaxy of letters all take on characters. Mm. You know, you became quite a favourite of mine,
I'm glad to hear that, because they were completely randomly assigned. Mm. And the other thing was, there were a couple of the epithets that I really just could not bear to give up, like the born again.
The born again is inspired.
I love the born again, and the law student, who I love. And the biographer, it was essential to keep that tag.
The other thing too I must ask is the idea that I seemed to sense, and maybe this is hindsight speaking, knowing the shape and depth of your career, about this notebook essentially being a slow turning away from fiction and a deeper fascination with the lives of others and the reportage of the lives of others. Did you sense that as well as you were capturing the, you know, your, that kind of 10-year period or that 9-year period?
Well, I've never been all that comfortable in fiction, you know. I mean, when I started to write nonfiction, that's when I felt that I felt at ease with it. I mean, I can write a novel, and I have written a couple of novels, but it doesn't feel all that natural to me. Whereas when I moved over to nonfiction, and I started realizing that that I could do it, and that I could do it, that I was quite good at it, and I thought, great, you know, I found the form that I can use. And then going back, actually, one person who read this book said that it reminded him of a novel because it had characters in it. Like you just said mm-hmm. before, you know, you was one that
the letter you was someone with,
that
yeah.
you felt
I liked
an
you.
Affinity with.
Hope you don't
but,
mind.
No. But I felt in a sense, I was going to say, one thing I left out when you mentioned the matter of the initials was how when I gave everybody an initial, it had a remarkable effect on the sort of texture of the book. It pulled it into shape. It was like running a sort of a thread through it, and it just pulled it tight. And I was amazed by that. It just suddenly it all started to hold together. And I don't know if it was because the people in it up until then had always been to me real people, but when I gave them an initial, that I suppose took them one step towards being a character. Although there's nothing in here that's made up about any of these people, but the fact that they've got some little fancy tag or name, it sort of frees them from their literal origin.
Mm.
Yeah.
The other thing that, I mean, there are many themes that come through, and this is why it is novel-like with you as a sort of central narrator. And that is the idea of fear, the sort of persisting to write out of fear, your fear of mediocrity. There's a lovely quote from Camus as well that, you know, once the talent of a person is recognised, then, of course, the misery of the creator begins. Are you still in terror, in fear, as not, you know, completing the sentence, not completing the promise of a story or a piece? Does fear still drive you?
Yeah, I wouldn't say, well, I was going to say I wouldn't say terror, but then I remembered what happens at 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm just lying there kind of helpless. 2 o'clock in the morning is a really bad time to, I have these bad times at 2 a.m. sometimes, and I feel completely overwhelmed by all the things that are ahead of me that I have to do or that I've said I would do and are pretending that I know how to do. But it took me a while to figure this one out, and it was quite a relief when I worked it out. I realised that at 2 a.m. the part of you that is not working is the ability to rank things in order. So you can't make a list. Mm-hmm. You can't think, okay, I'll do that first and I'll get that out of the way and then I'll do that. You can't do that at 2 o'clock in the morning. And so that's why you're in this complete swamp of panic. But when you wake up in the morning, you get up and you think, okay, I'll do this and then I'll do that. And everything becomes manageable again.
Triage. It's almost that casualties need to be sequenced, sorted.
Yeah. Yes, it's true.
Another quote that still intrigues me, and I'm sure it's one that sits very central to you, is when you confessed to Jay, you were having a few drinks with Jay, and you turned to Jay, and possibly after a martini or two, you said that I think there's something huge and one day it's going to roll over me. And elsewhere, you talk about this mighty force, a sense of the vast, of the infinite, saying it's benevolent, it's good, but to a degree, you're always running away from it. Have you identified what this force might be? Have you turned around to confront it?
That's a hard question. Well, when I used to have this experience of this being that I felt was in the room with me, it stood behind me, and I was afraid of it. I wasn't afraid because I thought it was dangerous to me. I just thought that it was some immense power or force, and that if I did turn around and acknowledge that it was there, I had no idea whether there was anything really in the room, but there was some force was in the room, and I knew that if I turned around and acknowledged it, it was going to demand something of me, and I didn't know what I felt that it was completely benevolent. I didn't think that it would destroy me or hurt me in any way, but I knew that it was something big, too big for me to cope with at that stage. Well, I described this to Tim Winton, and he said, "Oh well, you know," he said, "you know, I'm a Christian. I know what I would call that. Or firstly, the first thing he said mm-hmm. was, if something comes up to me in the dark, I call out to it and I ask it to identify itself. And I never did that. I didn't have the nerve to do that. But the other thing he said was, well, to me, it's the Holy Spirit. I think it's just the Holy Spirit. And I made a big mistake around the time. I tried to write about this in another book called Cosmo Cosmolino. And when that book was published, a lot of people were very embarrassed by it because they thought that I had, quote, become a Catholic, unquote, or, become some kind of religious nut because there were angels in that book and it was a strange book. But there were some people. I was being interviewed by a very rational kind of lefty journalist in Sydney, and I told him about this experience.
Yes.
And after I told him about it, I thought better of it, and I rang him up and I said, "Listen, would you mind not mentioning that? Because I feel that I've spoken too freely about it." He said, "Oh, don't worry, Helen. No, like I'm hardly going to mention it at all." And when I got the article, it was the main thing that, you know, and I thought, and he obviously thought it was ridiculous, and I did feel very painfully that I'd stupidly exposed myself. But anyway, I haven't answered your question. I mean, I would describe myself, I suppose, as some sort of Christian, and that mighty force is not something that frightens me anymore. I have found some way of accepting it, really.
Well, speaking of spirit, that certainly comes through salently, palpably in your book, The Notebook. In fact, James Wood, the New Yorker critic, has described you as being scrupulous, painstaking and detailed. In fact, a recording angel at life's secular apocalypse, and that certainly is very evident in this book. It's a delight to read and a codex to your illustrious career, Helen. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, David.